in which we run the gamut from industrial production to a good long hike and everything in between. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 17th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to slide into the macroeconomic news this Thursday with a little bit of industrial chicken and egg. First, we learned this morning from the Federal Reserve. They track all kinds of things, not just interest rates, you know. Anyway, the Fed told us that manufacturing output in this economy shrank 0.5% in September over a month earlier. Not in and of itself a ginormous deal, but you roll that in with the trade war and global slowing, and it is yet another thing to keep an eye on. Item number two, General Motors. Clearly, the five-week-long United Auto Workers strike that took GM's factories out of production contributed a bit to the manufacturing slowdown. How much? Not quite clear, hence the chicken and egg. But on that story, General Motors, workers got some details today about what could be their next union contract. The UAW released a summary this morning. Marketplace's Jack Stewart looks at what GM workers are considering now.
Anthony Smith is a third-generation GM worker. He's been on strike with thousands of others over issues like the company's use of temp workers.
These people are putting in all the same work we are, and they're not getting hired.
Smith was on the production line at Lordstown for nearly a decade. He transferred to Spring Hill, Tennessee, before Lordstown closed. Now the temps he works with will become permanent after 2 years on the job, according to the union. But Smith is concerned to see that a parts depot in California, which employs 55 people, will close. That's on top of the closures in Lordstown, Baltimore, and Warren, Michigan that were announced last year.
The UAW told us there would be no concessions in this, and I obviously see that as a concession of closing anything and affecting any worker.
GM did agree to keep a Detroit factory open. Smith wants to see all the details, but right now this deal doesn't sound like it was worth striking for.
Absolutely not. It seems like we got what GM put out there that they offered hours before we went on strike.
Kristen Gichak from the Center for Automotive Research says, no, workers didn't get everything they wanted, but...
That's how collective bargaining usually works, is that the result is somewhere in the middle and not everybody loves it, but they can live with it.
Art Wheaton from the Worker Institute says strikers have to be practical, and this deal does come with a signing bonus of up to $11,000.
If you've gone 5 weeks without getting a paycheck or just getting the $250 per week strike pay, having that ratification one can help them get caught up on their bills.
After GM's deal is approved, attention will turn to Ford and Fiat Chrysler, but Wheaton says those two contracts will be very similar to this one. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Loath though we are to give away airtime to our underwriters for nothing, love them though we do, this ad from back in March came to mind this morning.
Marketplace is supported by Invest Northern Ireland, a European location with a global reputation for excellence and people with a mindset that can deliver results. Northern Ireland, altogether more. Learn more at investni.com.
Now, you might rightly ask why we thought of that this morning. It's because after years of negotiation and frustration and ill will aplenty, there is a deal on Brexit, a deal that hinges almost entirely on the economic border between the Republic of Ireland and the British province of Northern Ireland. Parliament votes on Saturday. It's a political toss-up, analysts say. But for Northern Ireland, which has had its share of economic challenges, there's a whole lot riding on this. From the European Desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard is on that one.
On the face of it, Northern Ireland should be celebrating. The deal, if it goes ahead, would leave the province in a very privileged position, facing no tariffs at all in its two biggest markets. Stephen Booth is with the Open Europe think tank.
This deal grants it access to both markets, the home market of Great Britain, but also the EU market.
But Northern Ireland isn't celebrating. For one thing, the Democratic Unionists, the biggest political party there, opposes the latest deal. That, says John Corley of Cornell University, could be a problem.
So if it doesn't go through, then there continues to be uncertainty. I think there might be an argument for saying that just having any plan in place would eliminate some uncertainty.
And the uncertainty of Brexit has already hit Northern Ireland hard, deterring much-needed private sector investment. The province's economy has improved a lot since peace broke out there 2 decades ago. But Mark Blythe, who teaches political economy at Brown University in Rhode Island, points out the grim reality. It's mostly English taxpayers that keep Northern Ireland afloat with an $11 billion a year subsidy.
What's Northern Ireland's economic progress apart from being a part of the British state? Over 60% of consumption in Northern Ireland is basically government transfers. It's an economically depressed region.
If Brexit does eventually happen, those English taxpayers may feel even less inclined to prop up the beleaguered province. It's hardly surprising that in the EU referendum, the majority in Northern Ireland voted to remain. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a little bit bouncy up at the close, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I'll understand if somehow this has slipped your mind, given the fire hose that is the news cycle here in the late teens of the 21st century. But there are more tariffs going into effect tomorrow. Not China this time. It's Europe. Whiskies, both Irish and Scotch. French wines, Italian cheeses and meats, a whole list of other stuff. And they are steep, too, those tariffs, by the way, 25%. They come after the United States won at the World Trade Organization in a case accusing the European Union of giving Airbus, the big plane maker, illegal subsidies. Those tariffs are basically an approved form of international trade damages by the WTO. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has more on how these goods in particular got caught up in the fight.
For 50 years, Sal DiPaolo's been wrapping up cheese and meat behind the counter at DiPaolo Fine Foods in Little Italy in Manhattan.
Fresh mozzarella, 944.
DiPaolo's great-grandfather opened his first store in 1910. DiPaolo and his brothers and sister now run the business. They import all kinds of stuff from Italy.
If you look around the store, we got cheeses hanging, provolone from Naples. Our windows are garnished with prosciutto di Parma. These are items that are going to be affected.
Affected by the 25% tariffs going up on a whole variety of European goods.
25% more, it's a lot of money. It's a lot of money.
He's hoping that everyone along the supply chain can eat up some of the increased costs, but he says there's no way around it. Prices are going to go up for his customers, and he's worried how they're going to react. Provolone's $18 a pound without the tariffs. Prosciutto's $29 a pound.
The cheeses and meats that we sell now are high already. People are going to think twice.
The thing that really bugs DiPaolo, though, is that he, a guy who sells cheese and meat and olive oil, is having to pay the price for a trade dispute over airplanes.
I think it's unfair to everyone because it didn't relate to food. You want to stir the pot where it belongs.
But the fact these airplane-related tariffs are hitting European cheeses and wine is not an accident.
You're trying to hit the most politically motivated groups within those states so that you can get interest groups in the other states to lobby their own governments to repeal the policy you don't like. It's almost a collective punishment.
Rachel Brewster is a law professor at Duke. Maybe, the U.S. is betting, French wine producers and Italian cheesemakers will scream loud enough that the EU stops subsidizing its airplanes. The U.S. could focus all its tariffs on airplanes, but this way it can spread the pain across as much of Europe as possible. And European airplanes and airplane parts are kind of important to the U.S. economy in ways that European wine and cheese just aren't.
Normally what is hit is what's considered non-essential items. So it's unlikely that you're going to hit pharmaceuticals, for instance. You wouldn't want to raise the price of necessary drugs. But you tend to hit what people think of as luxury items.
American importers of those products, well, they're caught in the middle. And soon, more American companies are going to get caught, too.
There's a simultaneous case brought by the EU against the U.S. for subsidies to Boeing.
Simon Lester is Associate Director of the Center for Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. The U.S. lost that suit in the WTO. Turns out that while the EU subsidized Airbus, the U.S. subsidized Boeing too. And Europe is going to be awarded its own damages.
Within the next few months, there's going to be a similar ruling that lets the EU retaliate against the U.S. in some amount.
Whatever that retaliation will be, it is almost certain to be tariffs, and it will be designed to hurt.
The ideal is these tariffs are designed to force you to sit down and negotiate and, you know, change the government action that's at issue.
That's the way it's supposed to go, but the U.S. hasn't always operated within the rules of the WTO under Trump. So it's not clear if, when those EU tariffs come, the U.S. will negotiate or retaliate with other tariffs, like on automobiles, which would add a whole other group of people caught in the middle of a fight about airplanes. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
With the acknowledgement that we paint here with a very broad brush, there are two ways that discrimination in the housing market is brought to bear. Overtly, a racist landlord, for instance, refusing under one pretext or another to rent to certain groups of people. And then in a more subtle, sometimes unintentional way, policies that are neutral on their face but disproportionately affect those certain groups. That kind is known in regulatory and legal speak as disparate impact. And for decades, it's been used as a legal tool to establish and promote and maintain fair housing policies. But now, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, the Trump administration wants to change what is known as the disparate impact rule.
In 1999, an Oregon woman called the police and told them she'd been assaulted by her husband.
And as a result, her landlord sought to evict her under a policy that said households would be responsible for any criminal activity occurring in the home.
That's Sandra Park with the ACLU, which represented the woman in a successful effort to get the policy overturned.
And so that was a neutral policy on its face. But in applying it against domestic violence victims, it had a disparate impact on women.
The disparate impact rule under the Fair Housing Act has been used to fight zoning rules that perpetuate racial segregation and occupancy restrictions that keep out families with children. Now the Trump administration wants to make it harder to bring those cases. Aaron Headland is with the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. He says, among other changes, plaintiffs will have to prove that a policy is arbitrary and unnecessary and that the policy itself causes harm.
This rule change basically introduces more caution to say that, hey, if we're going to shut down a policy or bring lawsuits, then we want to make sure we can prove causality.
Fair housing advocates say that will make it harder to right past wrongs. Sharon Legenza is executive director of Housing Action Illinois, a coalition of fair housing groups.
The reason why disparate impact is so important is because under the Federal Fair Housing Act, we're trying to address not only intentional discrimination, but also the effects of longstanding segregation.
Tomorrow is the last day for public comments. Writing in the National Review today, HUD Secretary Ben Carson said the department will consider all of them seriously. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we've certainly, you know, taken a few punches along the way.
Cooking is a nasty business, gang. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 23 points today, basically flat, 27,025. The NASDAQ up 32 points, 0.4%, 81.56. The S&P 500 added 8, more than a quarter percent there, 29.97. With that possible Brexit deal, actually, there is a deal. Whether it's approved or not is a whole different thing. A look at where some British-based companies landed today. Retailer Marks & Spencer ticked up about 0.5% in energy. British Petroleum, properly known as BP, boosted 0.4%. Lloyds Bank trickled down about 0.1% today. A couple of Irish companies now in the name of fair play. Ryanair cruised up more than 0.25%. The food company Kerry Group sliced off about 0.3%. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.75%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money.
I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're going to go hiking now on the Pacific Crest Trail. It runs 2,500 miles from the Mexican border through California, Oregon, and Washington up to Canada, or vice versa, if you want to hike it that way. Hundreds of thousands of people do parts of it every year. Others buckle down and do the whole thing. But unlike most other federally managed infrastructure, the business plan for keeping the Pacific Crest Trail and some other national trails like it open depends on free labor. Marketplace's Ben Bradford has the story.
It's a hot, dry September morning outside of Los Angeles, and a crew of 18 men and women hike more than a mile in, carrying specialized hoes and axes. They're repairing some of the thin, rocky trail where it's wearing away and brush is encroaching. They fan out to scrape the path smooth, building a slight incline for water to run off.
There's no real rocket science to it, but you'll just get used to the tool.
67-year-old Jim Banks trains the new recruits. He's a retired tax attorney and a lifelong outdoorsman. He began walking sections of this trail about a decade ago and has been volunteering ever since.
I think that if you're going to hike the trail, you need to give back and help maintain it. Plus, I love being out here anyway.
Banks is part of a core group of older volunteers who come here sometimes multiple times a week. It's a community.
We've gotten to know each other really well, get along really well, have similar interests, you know, all about the same age of each other.
Volunteers have always been the key labor force for repairing national trails, but Banks says their role has grown. When he was in college, he worked for the U.S. Forest Service, which owns most of the land.
And they would work on the trails in their district everywhere. Now, I don't even know of a Forest Service trail crew anywhere. They've lost so much funding.
With much of that funding diverted to fight wildfires, between 1995 and 2015, the Forest Service lost 40% of its non-fire staff. So, the Forest Service provides hard hats and insurance, but it's retired bank trader Tim Morris who's clearing the trail with a long brush saw. Staying well behind him, 52-year-old building manager Thomas Reed clips anything Morris misses. It's only 9 a.m., but already sweat trickles down his face.
You can sit in an office and get tired. You can come out here and suck in some good air.
For Reed, the work has another meaning. He used to bring his 15-year-old daughter hiking. She died 6 years ago.
Anything that just brings me back to the natural universe makes me feel like I'm in touch with her.
He wants to one day hike the entire Pacific Crest Trail, a journey that can take half a year. The Forest Service calculates that last year, volunteers like Reed put in more than 1 million hours of trail maintenance across the country. The agency puts a monetary value on that work, $27 million. There are the regulars, and then a contingent of first-time volunteers. Aika Makamura is smoothing out one section of the path. She hiked almost all of the Pacific Crest Trail in 2017.
I need to get back to the trail. It took good care of me for 6 months. I was living on it for 6 months, so...
After a couple hours, it's break time. Volunteers sit in a semicircle and swap trail stories. Ava Ramondi describes meeting her boyfriend, Adam Boland, during a snowstorm on the Appalachian Trail.
I got into my tent, and he came hiking up, and he didn't know how to set up a tent, and he had the same one that I had. So he's like, can you please help me? And I was in my only, like, dry set of clothes. And no, I did say yes. I said yes.
After, Adam asked if he could tag along with her group.
I was like, hey, I don't know what I'm doing. Can I just follow y'all? And they were like, no. And I was like, I'm going to follow y'all anyway.
Still here.
The question is if these younger volunteers will be back. Further down the path, Claudio Silva, a tool and die maker, is stacking heavy rocks to support one vulnerable section of trail. He's been coming out here for 2 decades. He says the younger volunteers often don't return.
We need new blood is what we need, you know, because we have so many retired guys out here all the time, but... we need people to take their spot someday.
Because the trail relies on volunteers, and without them, it won't be there for the next generation of hikers. I'm Ben Bradford from Marketplace.
If you're a foodie, or maybe foodie adjacent, you may recognize the name Christopher Kimball. Tall guy, bow tie, founder of and for years the host of America's Test Kitchen, alongside its magazine, Cooks Illustrated, rigorously testing recipes until they were perfect. His latest venture, Milk Street, it's called, is focused less on perfection and more on flavor. The business model, though, is pretty similar. Television, radio, magazines, a culinary school, and a new cookbook called The New Rules. When we spoke last week, I asked Kimball what it's like to be known as a home cooking mogul.
I don't know. In this day and age, I'm not sure what mogul means,
well,
but
yeah.
I'm not a chef. I'm a home cook. And, you know, I've always been interested in how the typical home cook thinks about cooking. And it's quite different than, you know, a professional chef. So I'm more interested in the reality of the home kitchen than I am in the restaurant kitchen.
What does being a home cook mean to you? If you're not a chef, you've been in this business for a very long time. What does it mean to you to be a home cook?
I think it's about one of the last things you can do with your hands, where you actually make something and you can consume it and get the pleasure from it quickly. And it's something you can do with and for other people. You can't fix your car. You can't fix your lawnmower. You can't build your house. You can't do the plumbing. It's the last craft in America, I think, for most people.
Milk Street is a multi-platform, I think, is the lingo enterprise here, right? You've got books and television and radio,
right.
and there's an online presence. I imagine
right.
you collect and know an immense amount about the people who patronize your enterprise. Yes, big data is where I'm going.
Yeah, we do, although it depends on the platform. Our radio show and podcast is a different group of people who might watch the public television show. So it is platform specific, but we certainly use big data, sure.
Here's where I'm going with this. I wonder how much you think about pushing people in their home cooking versus making sure that they can do what you're suggesting, if that makes any sense.
Good point. I spent most of my career asking people what they wanted and giving it to them, which is a fairly safe way of being successful. I've now pivoted to deciding what I think they should do next and convincing them that that's a really good idea. The key there, as you suggested, was to be a step and a half ahead of them, not four steps. And so you start with something familiar and you slowly glide to something less familiar. But we've certainly, you know, taken a few punches along the way to understand how far people are willing to go.
You, as I said, had a very long relationship with America's Test Kitchen, which was rules-based, right? I mean, you guys tested the out of things and then presented
right.
them. Do you feel liberated now?
Exactly the right word. I've discovered that if I go and get on a plane and go to somebody's kitchen, I was just in Bologna, and cook with them, that they know so much more about cooking than I do, or at least they know a lot more about that kind of cooking than I do. And so it's opened up this whole world where there's still rules, you know, but the possibilities are endless and getting good food on the table is more joyful and easier if you see how most people around the world do it. You know, most people around the world have limited resources and they're locavores by definition. Mm. And they have to put big flavors on the table quickly, and they do it in ways that are astounding. So, yes, I'm liberated.
Take off your home cook hat and put on your entrepreneur hat. What keeps you up at night? Who's your competition? What's the boogeyman in the closet for you?
The world has totally changed the last 20 years from a few people in a monopolistic business, you know, the big food magazines, a few big food TV shows. Yeah. You can get information about cooking anywhere. So Google really is my... These good news and bad news.
Yeah, that's tough, man. If Google's your competition, you're in trouble.
Well, yeah, but look, there's a million places to get recipes. The question is, why would they want to come to us? And that gets to the heart of my business philosophy, which is today, I think, businesses are brands that people want to belong to. And I think that's where American business is moving. And we no longer have a sense of place. We don't have a sense of community. I think people are finding community in the brands they associate with. So creating something that's more than just a bunch of recipes is really where we spend our time.
The latest from Chris Kimball is called The New Rules. It's out of Milk Street. Chris, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
We posted some recipes from Milk Street's new book, The New Rules, it's called. Check them out, marketplace.org.
This final note on the way out today, Dateline, the Trump National Doral Golf Resort outside Miami via the White House press briefing room. Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney announced today that President Trump has decided to host next year's G7 summit of leading economies at his own club. David Farenthold, who covers the president and his businesses for The Washington Post, reports that the president's decision comes at a convenient time for the president's businesses. Doral's profits as of 2017 had fallen 69% over the preceding 3 years. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 23 points today. NASDAQ up 32 points. S&P 500 added 8. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, and Heron Bekela are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.